Well, I got a call from Opera Theater St. Louis. A friend of mine, his name is Gene Dobbs Bradford, who is head of Jazz St. Louis. And he called me up. He said, man, you think you ever want to write an opera? And I just thought he was joking. I was like, yeah, sure, man, no problem, whatever, you know.
When the call came from St. Louis asking Terrence Blanchard if he wanted to compose an opera based on the life of boxer Emile Griffith, he wasn't sure what to make of it. The New Orleans-born composer and multi-instrumentalist has written a lot of music, including countless film scores, most notably for the films of director Spike Lee, but he'd never written an opera before.
You know, I was floored by the opportunity,
yeah.
And I had 3 years to do it, and we're in the final stages of it now, printing up all of the music, getting it to the orchestra. The singers have had their parts already for months, and we start rehearsals next month. I feel like it's a really great opportunity, given the fact that, you know, I grew up listening to opera because of my father. You know, my father was a huge supporter of opera. He actually studied opera a little bit. He was a baritone, had a beautiful voice himself, but never sang professionally. And it just seems fitting, you know, at this stage in my career, with everything that I've done, that I've got an opportunity to do this now.
When you sat down to write the music for the opera, how much did you draw on the jazz tradition and how much on the operatic music tradition?
Well, I didn't even think of it in those terms, you know. Roger Dickerson is my composition instructor. I studied with him. And, you know, we just talked about, you know, allowing the music to tell you what it is. We're calling this an opera in jazz, but you're not going to hear a lot of swing, you know, things. There are going to be moments where that happens, obviously, but I look at it as a moment in time where we could take that language and use that language as a means to tell this story.
Emile Griffith had a very tragic life in many ways. Could you talk a little bit about his story?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about it is he's still living, you know, and he's suffering from dementia severely, so he's not totally aware of everything that's going on. But Emile Griffith was a fighter from the islands. Let me rephrase. He was a person from the islands who became a fighter, because while he was in the islands, he was just a young boy, and his mom sent him to live with his aunt in New York, where a trainer saw him and saw how physically fit he was and said, you know, hey man, have you ever boxed? And he said, no. And he started to train Emile as a young man and immediately recognized that this guy had talent, athletic talent. So all of a sudden he becomes a professional fighter. At the same time was struggling with his own sexuality and keeping that very much a secret. You know, this is the 60s. He fought a guy named Benny Perrette for the third time. Both of them fought each other and won each one fight out of the two that they had. And this was supposed to be the third and culminating contest. And in the press conference, Benny Perrette tried to gain advantage over Emil by calling him a mighty cone, which we know is a very derogatory term for a gay person. And in those days, you know, those were harsh words, as they are today. Emil had a bad premonition about the fight, that he just felt like something bad was going to go on, and actually he tried to get out of the fight, and he couldn't, obviously. Emil hit Benny 17 times without Benny responding. Emil won by technical knockout. You know, Benny fell into a coma and was in a coma for a number of days and then died. Emil's life took a spiral, obviously. He fought on and had a few fights after that, but could never really get himself together. Wound up working at a boys' home as a security guard, where he actually became attracted to one of the boys, but he never did anything with the kid until the kid graduated and was a man. You know, and they established a relationship. Well, you know, there were a lot of things that went on in Emil's life, but one of the things that he said, you know, because he never came out and said that he was gay, still hasn't said it to this day. But one of the things that he did say, you know, is that I killed a man and the world forgave me, but yet I love the man and the world has yet to forgive me. You know, and it's a very powerful notion when you think about it. And that was the thing that made me want to write the opera.
How much of the story in the opera is directly or literally based on Griffith's life, and how much of it is stylized or interpreted?
I think that 90% of it comes from his life. 95% of it comes from his life. The only parts that are stylized like, you know, basically the Howie character, who's a trainer, who was not necessarily one trainer in his life, you know, but we combined a few of those characters into one guy. But everything else is taken directly from accounts that were given in his autobiography and some other periodicals and just the historical record, really, you know. So we deem it in terms of the facts to be fairly accurate.
Do you think you could pick out a particular scene and tell me a little about how you went about matching the music to the dramatic content?
Oh man, there are numbers of scenes. Like the opening scene, you know, the whole opera is based around this one episode in Emile's life where he's going to meet Benny Jr. as a grown man and in Central Park.
And this is the son of Benny Parrott,
yes,
whom Emile
Benny
had
Jr.
killed in the fight, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what happens in the scene is, in real life, is that he meets Benny Jr. They're walking in Central Park, and Emile is starting to show the effects of dementia. He asks Benny Jr., says, "How's your mom?" And the guy says, "Well, you know, she's okay, but she just couldn't bring herself to come." And he says, "I understand." And then Benny says to Emile, he says, "You know, from the family standpoint, we just want to let you know we don't harbor any ill will towards you." And Emile just stopped in his tracks and just started crying, you know, lost it. You know, it was a very powerful moment. So we start the opera with a scene where Emile is getting dressed to go meet Benny Jr. And it starts off with him looking for his shoe. And the opera opens up with him saying, "This is my shoe. My shoe goes where? Where does my shoe go?" Musically, what I tried to create there is just this sense of not mystery, but confusion, just like a heartfelt pain for someone that you love suffering from dementia. So the melody itself is a very, very kind of sustained, very long, languid melody with a plaintive kind of piano thing in the background and some kind of mysterious ambient harmony from the strings. There are other scenes that are more rhythmic in tone. It's a scene called What Makes a Man a Man, and this is a moment in Emile's life where he's struggling with his sexuality, and he's asking himself this question: what makes a man a man? Is it the color of his hair? Is it the sound of his voice? Is it the way he walks? Is it the way he talks? You know, is it the clothes that he wears? Is it, you know, what makes him strong? Is it love? Does love make you strong or does love make you weak? You know, inside or outside? That's the constant refrain, inside, outside. I took a lot of time in terms of taking those words and finding rhythm within those words and then finding the very poignant parts when you say inside, outside, the very reflective parts, and isolated those parts and tried to build everything melodically up until the moment when you say inside, outside, because we all have had that moment in our lives when you have to ask yourself, who am I and what am I doing, when you're looking at yourself in the mirror. And everything melodically is geared to go to those specific points in that scene. And then it builds to a huge climax at the end. And it's right before he has the fight with Benny. So for me, it's a very powerful moment because it's a very reflective moment. It's a moment that kind of marks a shift in his life based on everything that he was going through in his life, becoming a professional fighter, yet still not admitting to himself or to the world that he's gay. It's very powerful. It's a powerful libretto, man, that Michael Christopher has written.
So what phase are the preparations in at this point?
Oh, the final phase. The only thing, I have rewritten one scene and we're, you know, getting the parts done for that, but everything else is done. And we start rehearsals next month.
And what sort of role will you be playing in the rehearsal process?
Hopefully my role will be just as a spectator if I did everything right. If I put all the notations and all the articulations and dynamics in the music the right way. I mean, but you know, there's always going to be questions asked. And I think one of the reasons why there's going to be questions asked in this production is because You know, even with the singers that we used in the workshops that we had, there was always this question of, should I sing it like a jazz singer? And it's like, no, that's not what we're going for. We're going for something that's very natural, something that's just to the point, you know? So there are going to be decisions that are going to have to be made in terms of whether the singers are going to sing certain things in full voice, you know, the full operatic sound, or something in between. But those are the moments that you always look forward to in rehearsal, because those are the final details that, you know, anyone uses in any production of anything, you know, that kind of brings it all together. You know, it's like when we did the album for Blue Note, you know, you conceive of these concepts and songs and you put them together, but then you get into rehearsal and you get in the studio and you listen back and you go, hey, man, maybe we should do this here. And then you just start to whittle away at the finer things, and then it all starts to take shape.
Are there any existing pieces of music that you really drew on during the writing process?
Probably indirectly, but there's nothing that I specifically listened to. You know, there was some, I went and listened to Lulu, and I listened to, you know, Zalame, Ghost of Versailles. There were things, but that was early on in the process. You know, when I started writing, I tried not to listen to anything, because I knew if I would, I'd become very self-conscious. And I didn't want to have that looming over me. I just wanted to get everything out of my system, you know, and sit down and write. And like I said, let the text and the story tell me what it is. And then just move from there, you know, because the thing that I had to come to terms with is this whole notion of what is opera, you know. And the thing that I drew from is the same thing that happens when people ask me, what is jazz? Or what is film music, you know, there's certain things, obviously, rhythmic things that kind of indicate where the history of those musics come from, right? But the innovations in those musics are left up to the individual. And the thing that I've always learned is that some of the greatest people that I've loved in any genre of music have had the courage to just do what it is they feel best, no matter where the chips may fall.
Was writing this opera anything like work you've done scoring films in the past?
There's nothing to do. It is such a different world. I can't explain it. It is such a one of the reasons why it's such a different world is that the singers are always singing. Because, you know, it's a story set to music. With the singers constantly singing, and this basically being an all-male cast, it's totally different than film, because I have to look at these voices like I'm directing characters, which is something I've never done in film. You know, when I get to film, that portion is already done. You know, I have to give intent to the line. You know, and what was technically very difficult is the whole notion of keeping an audience's interest with all of these voices that are in the same register. The human voice doesn't have the same register as an instrument. You know what I mean? And it functions very differently. You know, for example, there are certain registers, while the voice can produce sound, it can't produce volume. You know, and that's just a practical thing. You know, so you can sit down and say to yourself, oh, I wanted this to be belted out, but it won't happen because physically, singers in certain registers can't do certain things. And those are the things that I had to learn. So in that regard, it's a very, very different process, you know. And the only thing that may be similar is that I'm still enhancing scenes. But the thing you have to realize is that in opera, not only are you enhancing the scene, but you are shaping the principles as well. You know, because I can read a script, man, for a film, and I try not to get started just based on reading the script, because you have actors, you know, give their performances. The tempo is a little faster than what I probably imagine it would be. The voices sound different from what I imagine it would be. The way it's shot, it's totally different from what I would imagine it to be. But it's all done by the time I get it. In opera, none of that is done. It's totally the opposite. You know, so it's a very different process.
So you have a lot more influence on the structure of the whole work as it's evolving than you would with a film where you're just handed a finished product to score.
Exactly. And the thing is, the staging part of it still plays a big role as well, you know, but that's where the collaborative process comes in, working with a director like Jim Robinson, you know, where we can sit down and talk about, okay, well, I envision this happening in this scene, so maybe I'm going to need this to occur to get some people off and on the stage, you know. We're going to have these types of transitions. I've been talking to the set designer because we think that we're going to use this because a lot of the opera takes place in Emile's apartment. Then we transition from his apartment to a boxing ring and some other settings. So, you know, those guys will have influence on what it is that I do as far as that's concerned, but still that's doesn't really come to life until after I've written the music.
Stepping backwards in time a little bit, how did you first get into to film scoring?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was simple. It was fate, I guess. You know, Spike had called me to play on some of his film scores. I played on School Days, and I played on Do the Right Thing. Then we were doing Mo' Better Blues. And we needed to record some music for Denzel and Wesley to sync to while they were shooting. So prior to them doing the production, we went to the studio and recorded these tracks. And in the middle of the session, we were taking a break, and I happened to be working on some music for my first solo project for Columbia Records. And I sat at the piano and I started to play this tune that I had written for the kids in South Africa who were massacred. It was called Sing Soweto. Spike walked by and goes, "Hey man, you know, what is that?" And I said, "Oh, something I'm working on." And then he asked if he could use it, you know, and I didn't know how he was going to use it, but we recorded it at that moment just as a solo trumpet piece because he wanted to use it for a scene in the movie when Denzel was up on the bridge playing. And then he shot the scene, and when he shot the scene, Spike kept trying to fill in on because I came over to the studio one day when they were doing this. He tried to fill in the scene with ambient noise, which wasn't working. So then he asked me if I could write a string arrangement for it, and I did, and brought it in. And his father was doing the music for the film, so his father said, "Well, you wrote it, you conduct it." So he put me in front of the orchestra, and that was really a great moment for a lot of reasons, man, because there was such a euphoric high you can get from standing in front of 70 people, waving your hands and have them play something you've written. You know, it's a powerful thing. So I was juiced, dude. You know, when we finished doing it, even though the arrangement was a very simple arrangement, I was still juiced. The first time I'd ever done anything like that. And Spike said, you know, you have a future in this business. And I'll never forget, we were at BMG Studios, and it was like fate hit me over the head, because just when I had that very euphoric experience of doing that, I walked out of the studio and I walked up to where the men's room was. And right outside the men's room, there was this mastering room for this other engineer, and he was mastering Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. And it was a very, very animated moment in the orchestra. All of this stuff going on. And I remember sitting there going, "Wow, my arrangement didn't sound like that." So, you know, just as I was on this euphoric high of having this experience, man, you know, it was like the good Lord was saying, "No, let me bring you back down to reality, you know, because if you're going to do this, you're going to realize how much homework you have to do."
Yeah.
But then Spike called me to do Jungle Fever after that, man, and then, you know, our relationship was kind of off to the races after that.
Is that the first time you'd written for a large ensemble?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It was something that I always wanted to do, but obviously I had never gotten an opportunity to do because, you know, being in high school, you're not going to get many opportunities to write for orchestra. And then being a jazz musician, you're not going to get many. So that was something that I really cherished. And I thought it was going to be a one-time thing. I didn't think nothing of it. But then he called me to do Jungle Fever.
So returning to the present, you have a new album coming out entitled Magnetic, which features a lot of great guest performers alongside your normal group. And you'll be playing at Jazz Fest, kind of promoting the new album. It's coming out around that time. Do you have any particular plans for the Jazz Fest show? Are you going to be joined by any of the guests from the record?
Well, Leon Eloweke, Ravi Coltrane, and Ron Card, all the guests on the album. But we're just going to be playing the music with the quintet. We've been having a lot of fun with this group, man. I'm very proud of all these young men. You know, Kendrick Scott, he has his own album out called Conviction. Fabian Amazon, Kendrick is a drummer. Fabian Amazon, the pianist, is mastering his CD right now. Joshua Crumbly on bass, and Bryce Winston on tenor saxophone, who has his own CD that's been released too. So these guys are very special young men, man. They're visionaries. You know, we've always had a great time playing at Jazz Fest. Jazz Fest is kind of like our home away from home. You know, it's become that. You know, it's being one of the regulars that have played the festival a number of years. I look forward to that time. I can't explain. I play a lot of Jazz Fests around the world, you know, but playing Jazz Fest in New Orleans has always been a special thing. And I think partly it's because, you know, I run into so many people that I grew up with, so many people that I've known in the city, and then other people that I've known from around the world who always come to Jazz Fest. It's always one of the things that's always amazed me about that festival. I run into people who make their regular pilgrimage to the city, you know, and it's always a nice, beautiful experience to have.
Well, I think that about wraps it up. Thank you very much, Terrence, and good luck with everything.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.